again, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and this is the My View Matters Radio Network. Just to get started this week, something I enjoy is this political rhetoric generator because it's entertaining. So today's random rhetoric-generated message is that I refuse to support an America where drunk companies and Mexicans can destroy our love for Jesus. And on that note, welcome to the program, folks. I hope you've all had a good week. Bit of good news on the network. Dale the Truth will be back this Thursday. He's been on hiatus dealing with some personal issues and dealing with life, and so we're happy to welcome him back to his show this week. At least that's what he had told me, so I'm hoping that he's back this week. And, of course, since I'm talking about Dale on Thursday nights, I should go ahead and mention, too, that we have Ed Springsteen here Monday through Wednesday at 7 o'clock as well. So all the shows on the network Sunday through Thursday are at 7 p.m., and, of course, invite you to listen to all of them. All different, all unique, and all good stuff. So to get started, there was a story that came out this week about, and it was interesting because it was reported from the United Kingdom, that it was a story about, were children smarter a century ago? And the test specifically talks about a 1912 test from Bullitt County, Kentucky, which I thought was kind of interesting. And, you know, it's interesting. There are some things in here that I would have not been able to do, spelling specifically. Some of these words are words we don't use anymore. Or at least I've never used them. Antecedent, I'm not a big you, that'll probably be the last time you ever hear me say that word. The math stuff was all pretty straightforward. It was interesting. Some of it was a little bit complex and actually required thinking it out. But, not too bad. And this is an eighth grade test. So some of the stuff that you would have to figure out that, with common sense, things you would have needed to know. The only thing I really didn't know in the math section was a cord. So if a cord of wood, I've heard that term. I don't know how much a cord actually is because when I go buy firewood, I just go, yeah, it looks about right. How much does that cost? So I don't have a wood-fired fireplace, so I don't buy wood by the cord. I buy, stuff for camping out or whatever, and that's just a pile of wood. Some other things is just interesting, grammar, geography, and of course, some of that stuff's kind of interesting. Being over 100 years ago, the history of the country has almost doubled since that time, and there's stuff that was probably more important then to the history of the country than now. But it is an interesting question. What are we teaching children now versus a century ago? Is it something that's important? Are there things that were fundamental then that really should be fundamental now that aren't? I don't know. It's an interesting topic for discussion. But I just found it interesting, especially since it was reported in a paper over in the UK, and it was about Bullitt County, Kentucky. So I just found that to be interesting. And speaking of interesting, I should mention, if you want to call in about anything we're talking about tonight or whatever topic, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And you can just press 1 if you would like to speak. But if you don't press 1 when you're prompted to, then I won't know you want to speak. You'll just be sitting there listening, which people do listen to the show that way. And so I won't know to pick up. So throw that out there. There's people that have sent me messages after the show saying, hey, I was on hold for 20 minutes and you never picked up. Well, that's because you never pressed the 1 key to let me know you wanted to speak. So anyway, from the Associated Press, and this has been a month ago, and I think we've talked about this on the show before, David Adams has filed 3 lawsuits in Kentucky. The third suit, one's about, let's say here, the first suit was Obamacare, the second suit, and it's setting up the exchanges, the second suit was about expanding Medicaid, Medicare, I guess it's Medicare, and then the third suit is about economic incentives, and, you know, this is something that is kind of important, and people don't really understand. And on the surface, it sounds great. Sure, you know, we've lured a company to our state, and they're going to employ 100 people or whatever. And that sounds okay. But these incentives have a very negative effect on our communities. And, you know, not always, of course. I mean, Toyota is probably a great example of one that's not failed, right? Toyota has a giant plant in Georgetown and employs a lot of people, even people that live up in my neck of the woods up here in Pendleton County. But definitely people in Harrison County, Grant County, and the counties all surrounding Scott County certainly benefit from that being there. But when you start talking about putting incentives in, the problem that you have, there's multiple problems. First, there's going to be a need to increase infrastructure. I mean, especially if you're bringing in a large company, there's going to be a need to increase your infrastructure. Well, if no one or if the business isn't paying taxes on that, then that means that everybody else is. The money doesn't come from heaven. There needs to be a place where the money comes from. And so basically you're picking up the share for everyone else, or everyone else is picking up the share for that one business. And you can make the claim, well, you know, it would be better than having all these people unemployed. And that might be true, but the other side of that is that perhaps those people would have been doing something else. Maybe they would have been starting their own business. Maybe they would have been working for some other business. And, of course, there's the issue that we've seen in multiple communities around the state is that they give these 10-year exemptions on taxes. When the 10-year ticker runs out, the company just moves again. And a good friend of mine came up with a great term for these companies that do this. They hop from location to location based on tax incentives. He called them piranhas. All they do is feast upon the community, and once those tax incentives are gone, they leave. And the real problem with that is if the company leaves, they leave a gaping hole. Either the people have to move with that company, or the company moves and those people have no jobs. And if you're bringing in large companies and they leave a gaping hole in a community, a hole that wouldn't have existed had they not put the incentives in, and it would have over time gradually been filled in by small businesses or local community things. People wouldn't have built their lives necessarily around the increased standard of living based upon that company being there. And more importantly, because all these other entities have to pay the taxes, they're not able to expand their businesses. So your mom and pop corner store that's been around for 15, 20 years all of a sudden has to carry part of the tax burden that this other company isn't paying, that's paying for increases in infrastructure that may or may not actually help their business. If they're not on the roads that lead to this new business, then they're not really being helped by that. And you could make the claim that, well, you know, that's extra money in the community, so they're helped. Well, maybe, but you're still causing a large disruption in the community if that company moves out. And the only reason they came there was because of the incentive. Now, some stay, like Toyota, and many leave. Up here in northern Kentucky, we saw Omnicare do this. We saw, I think it was Nielsen, the same thing. And I've been told that this is something that happens around the state, that businesses come and they go, and they do so based upon these incentives. And so, to me, the smart thing to do is to create a level playing field, equal rules for everybody. If you want to encourage businesses to grow, then lower their regulations. And we, I believe we talked about that story last week or the week before, somewhere along the line, that there's now proof that the more regulations, and it's a study that shows, the more regulations there are, the harder it is on business and the fewer jobs there will be. So if you really want to encourage growth, you should be doing it by cutting regulations, by cutting taxes, by focusing on absolutely core critical services, not on fluff projects that really don't benefit the community over the long term. And these are the things that then let our small business people, the people that live in our communities, the people that care about our communities because they're a part of our community. They've lived there. They raise their children there or their grandchildren there or whatever. They care. They have roots in that community. That's how you build a stable community, in my opinion, is you let it happen organically. No, none of this big government puppeteering of, oh, well, we'll put this person here and they'll get this tax incentive and they'll come here and we'll put them in this plot of land over here. I mean, there's a number of – we did talk about this last week, I believe, or the week before, about LaGrange, Kentucky, being in deep, deep financial trouble because they built this big industrial park and then no one came. You know, and that's more of that tinkering. If they had just left it alone, and if the businesses wanted to come there, certainly they could have bought the land. Certainly they could have improved it. Certainly they could have built the facility. Or if a free market-minded person saw an opportunity to do that, then they would have been the ones to make that investment. They are the ones who have their rear end on the line, and not the taxpayers of LaGrange, Kentucky. Letting your communities grow organically is good for so many reasons. The old saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, think about that. Do you really want to put everything into two or three large companies? And if those two or three large companies move out, your city falls apart? I mean, that's not a really good way to run anything. I mean, if you have two or three critical failures, you're done. Whereas, you know, small businesses obviously come and go as well. There are a number of folks that I know, and in fact, I have run a small business that was not successful. That isn't to say that they didn't do the right things or whatever. It just may have been the wrong time, wrong location. There's a number of factors. But at least when those small businesses go under, you're looking at employee layoffs of, you know, one, somewhere numbering between one, right, the owner, and maybe 50 people. Whereas, you know, quite honestly, if Toyota decided to pull up and head out and get out of Georgetown, that would wreak massive, massive economic turmoil, not just in Scott County, but in Harrison and Grant and all the surrounding counties. It would be devastating to that area. And so my point is that we shouldn't be doing this tinkering, this big government planning stuff. What we should be doing is letting our communities grow organically. And so David Adams has filed a lawsuit basically trying to stop this practice, claiming, and I think rightfully so, that it's not equal protection. You can't give special tax breaks to some at the expense of others. How does that cut the mustard as far as equal protection? And I do have a big problem with that. I don't see that it's fair. It's not fair to the small mom and pops that have been there before who now have an extra tax burden. You know, why do they have to subsidize some other business? You know, and on top of it, again, it's not organic. It can cause major disruptions. And like I said, knock on wood, you know, that Georgetown plant, Toyota Georgetown plant, stays there forever and keeps supplying good jobs to the area. I mean, that would be great. But, you know, at the end of the day, if Toyota decides, I mean, heck, Toyota could go out of business. Something horrible could happen, and I'm not wanting that to happen at all. But if it did, the devastation that would occur would be immense. I mean, that was the whole reason we supposedly bailed out the automakers, although it didn't really do a whole lot of good. We've all seen the news about Detroit. But that was why, ostensibly, we did that. We tried to stop that devastation in all these these communities across America with plants shutting down. And the reality is that, ironically, we actually caused even more problems with the bailout. Again, every time big government gets its fingers stuck in it, it gets worse. And that should be the lesson we learn. We should be letting things happen organically. We should not be pushing them, especially not with government. And so I do support this lawsuit that David has filed. I'm hoping to get him on the show sometime in the near future. David's a very busy man. He does have three lawsuits running against across the state. But I'm hoping to get him on at some point. And I guess the reason this is relevant right now, I think it's Monday or Tuesday is the first hearing on this case. So we'll obviously keep you up to date on how the case progresses. Again, I think that that's an important thing to follow and an important thing to figure out, you know, that we really shouldn't be doing it anyway. And I'm hoping that if nothing else, the lawsuits will bring the issue to the forefront so that we can actually have some public discourse on it. And speaking of issues coming to the forefront here, one of the big things coming along is this Bluegrass Pipeline. Now, for those of you not in a county with the Bluegrass Pipeline running through it, what they're basically planning on doing is running a giant natural gas pipeline from somewhere down in, I can't remember if it's Oklahoma or Texas, somewhere down there, all the way across up to somewhere in Pennsylvania. It's a very long pipeline. It's a natural gas pipeline. And there are some concerns about this. Obviously, some people are concerned about safety. My primary concern is how in the world are they going to get this land? And I'm really worried they're going to try to do this through eminent domain. And the eminent domain thing actually brings in the security or the safety questions. Because if this ends up being some sort of state co-op or something like that that owns this pipeline, then if there's a rupture, if it's not properly maintained, if it's whatever, they're going to claim sovereign immunity. It's one of the reasons why I, as much as I like the idea of nuclear power, I can't support it today. Because at a federal level, who's responsible? Do you know who's responsible if a nuclear power plant melts down today in America? By federal law, it's not the plant operator. It's you and I. They have sovereign immunity built in for these nuclear power plants. So that's my problem with it, is that there's no liability. And I think we've talked about that a number of times on this show, that liability is the ultimate check and balance on bad behavior. The BP oil spill is another great example of how government creating limits on liability hurts us. There's no reason that those companies would have been drilling so deeply in the Gulf of Mexico were it not for the fact that Congress had passed a law capping their liability. And somewhere a bean counter, and that's how businesses work, especially big ones. They work by bean counters. What's the risk-reward for this situation? And because of the capped liability, the risk was capped. By an act of Congress, the risk was capped. And the reward, I mean, if you hit, you know, a good pocket of oil out there, that's great. That's lots of money. And so you throw that equation out of whack through government regulation, and you can cause some real problems. People start doing things that are risky, unnecessarily risky. Risk and reward is a great balance, and the risk part of that is the liability, especially in a situation like drilling in super deep water or running a pipeline from Oklahoma to Pennsylvania that's full of natural gas. And so it's no surprise that people are very concerned about this. But the company that's doing this has the they know what's going on. They've paid attention to Kentucky politics and probably politics in every state across the way. So they've hired Stites and Harbison. Stites and Harbison is a very powerful law firm. For those that don't know, in Kentucky, very powerful law firm. And the person working on this project for the company specifically is Boardwalk Pipeline Partners, is Andrew Beshear, who is Steve Beshear's son. And so there's been some allegations of some shadiness just because it's Andrew Beshear, the governor's son. Now, I don't look at it just from that, right? I mean, hey, the governor's son is a citizen like you and I of the state, and he needs to work. And so I don't fault him for having a job. What I'm worried about is, are they going to use eminent domain? Is there going to be sovereign immunity? Is there going to be the proper liability, the proper checks and balances on this thing? Are people going to be compensated properly for their land if it's seized by eminent domain? Or will they just carve a right-of-way through and make the person responsible for the land all around the stupid pipeline, the individual landowners, and they just have to let, you know, these employees, these government people, whoever is in charge of maintaining the pipeline, onto their property at any time because of the right-of-way. That's my concern with it. I'm not really worried. If we don't have a situation where liability is capped, and we don't have a situation where they're using eminent domain to take people or use land, not take people's land, or force people to allow the use of their land, then I think it's okay. Because if the liability is in place, they're going to make sure that that thing doesn't rupture, right? The last thing they want is a several million dollar lawsuit. I mean, no company wants to get socked with that. On top of the bad publicity, it's also losing money. You know, and in the case of BP, they were shamed into helping more than they were legally required to do. But that was just public shaming. And they still didn't pick up that full bill. The taxpayers helped pick up a lot of that bill. And so my point is, if this is a private company doing this, which it is, then it should be done the right way. The private company should be buying the land. It should be buying all the land for a fair price, not using eminent domain to condemn and take, or, you know, forcing right-of-way through people's property. And they should be fully liable for any harm or any damage or any problems that pipeline causes. And at that point, the issue kind of goes away, because that means they have to be good stewards of their pipeline. And they bought the land. So if they bought the land and they're a good steward of their pipeline, then, whatever. I mean, that's, you know, energy is important, so moving that around is fine. I just don't want to see the government get in the way and have protecting people and their property and all that stuff. So anyway, that's some of the interesting Kentucky news going on. Nationally, saw a story here about Obamacare. Congress is exempting themselves and their employees from the Obamacare rate increases. Now, there's a number of conflicting stories out there about what's going to happen and what was going to happen and what is going to happen and is it really saving money or whatever. And the reality is, no matter what happens, Democrats are going to claim that it's better than it would have been, and Republicans are going to claim it's worse than it would have been. And that's, unfortunately, we're probably never really going to get a real good understanding of this. I've had this discussion before with numerous people we've talked about on the show. This thing's not going to work. I mean, trying to cram a one-size-fits-all plan on top of 300 million people is not going to work. And it creates new bureaucracy, and with bureaucracy comes cost. And so there's no way that it can actually save money, because you're creating more bureaucracy. It inherently creates more expenditures, because these hospitals, these healthcare providers, will have to comply with the new bureaucracy, thus have to spend more money. But there's a story about this, and basically the plan here, we've heard from the unions now that are screaming that they don't want Obamacare. We've obviously from the right, some of them were screaming about it just because Obama did it, and some of them for legitimate reasons. And people like myself screamed about it because my health insurance goes away next year, which I'm really not happy about. But essentially, the benefits for federal employees are pretty sweet. And they pick up a huge portion of the cost of health care, more so than any other private employer. I mean, that's been the trend here, you know, as of late, is that private employers are picking up more and more of the cost, they're passing along more and more of the cost to employees, which is really why it looks like we're paying more for health insurance, and even more than the rate is going up, because more of that is being passed through to us. So in the past, if it was that we were picking up 50% and your employer was picking up 50%, it may now be that you're picking up 60% and your employer is only picking up 40%. And that's kind of been the trend for a number of years, is the shifting of the burden to the individual employee. But in the case of federal employees, and specifically these congressional staffers, 75% of their premiums are being covered by the federal government. So the federal government, using our tax money, pays 75% of the premiums for the health plan provided to the federal government employees, which is a heck of a lot sweeter of a deal than you or I get. That's been something for a long time now, or growing in the last decade especially, though, that in the public sector, it used to always be you got great benefits, but the pay was kind of, not so good, right? And it was made up for in benefits. What's shifted in the past 10 years is that the public sector employees are now being paid as well as their private sector counterparts, but have still been able to retain those old public sector benefits that the private sector hasn't had in a decade or two or more. And that's where things are getting out of whack. No one in the private sector really has a pension anymore. I mean, there's people at my company are grandfathered in, but at this point, there's no one new going into the system. I was kicked out. I think I get to collect like $3 a month for the rest of my life if I work there for the next 25 or 30 years. I can't remember now. I think it's 25 years I have to work there full-time. And then based on what I've contributed, I'll get a whopping like $3 a month, which, by then will probably worth what 3 cents is today. So I keep joking they ought to buy me out for $300. But the point is that there are inequities, and that is part of what's driving our debt, is that we keep making these promises that we can't keep. This is what's destroyed Detroit, the pensions. Detroit owes $11 billion. They're in the hole, $11 billion. $9 billion of that hole is created by their pension system. I mean, that's almost 10% of their budget hole. That's almost 90% of their budget hole, or their debt, rather. Man, I'm not getting this straight today. I apologize. 90% of their debt, almost 90% of their debt, is driven by their pension. And that is the same we're seeing throughout many governments, even here in Kentucky. The majority of our debt liability, our future liabilities, increasingly becomes our public sector pensions. And if we had solved the problem and started to phase them out in the 80s, when people said, hey, these pensions, they're not really sustainable. Oh, but we won't be here, so who cares? We'll just kick it down the line. If we'd solved the problem back in the 80s, we'd be fine. But we didn't solve the problem. The can was kicked down the road. It was kicked down the road in the 90s, kicked down the road in 2000s. And here we are now in the 2010s, 20-teens. And the can's not really going to go much further. That can has been dented up, crushed, smacked around. It's got some holes in it, some jagged edges. Kicking it down the road is it's not going to go very far, and it might cut your toe. So, anyway, I went way too long on a number of these stories here at the beginning of the show. We're going to take a break here. If you'd like to call in, you can do so at area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And we're just going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll continue with the stories. I got fun things about bureaucracies and the rift in the Republican Party. And, of course, hey, there was Fancy Farm. I mean, that happened yesterday. That's a big deal, too. So we've got a lot left to cover. Come on back here. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Losing soul, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me. Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, folks, and we're back. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network, and we are here live every Sunday night at 7 p.m. And if you're listening to the podcast, we appreciate that. But if you'd like to listen live, call in, all that good jazz, you can do so. We're here, again, every Sunday night, 7 o'clock Eastern time. And the number here, in case you are listening live, is 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And if you'd like to talk, you have to press 1 when you're prompted to do so. So getting right back to it here, as I mentioned, I'm way behind, so we need to catch up. Interesting story. You know, New York City, the mayor there, Bloomberg, is nut, and he likes to be a little nanny. And it's entertaining because they're pushing this program in New York City to get doctors to prescribe fruits and vegetables to people. And ironically, so you have one bureaucracy trying to push fruit and vegetable prescriptions. Meanwhile, the FDA is saying, hey, you can't prescribe that. Fruits and vegetables haven't been tested by the FDA. And it entertains me greatly to watch bureaucracies beat each other to death, because that's entertaining for me. And I hope it's entertaining for you. It's kind of points to the silliness of government, in that when one fiefdom encroaches into the fiefdom of another, ugly things happen. So you've got New York City and the FDA beating each other up over whether or not doctors can prescribe people to eat fruits and vegetables. It's silly but funny. Speaking of silly and funny, Bill Maher apparently had recently urged rich liberal celebrities to buy a state. And this had conservative people on Facebook all up in arms. Oh, my gosh. I mean, that's crazy. And, of course, they would do that. Well, here's the thing. It's a free market solution. They're going to buy it. So they go in, they buy. When they say buy a state, you're talking about buying land, moving into that state. Certainly, they can go and do all that. But the other alternative, and I think what they're really pushing, is not really taking over a state, but really going in and just affecting the outcome of elections by donating money to certain people. And, you know, I don't think that that's really going to work. I think there are instances where there are states that are kind of on the cusp and could go either way, but the majority of states and the majority of districts are not that way. I mean, especially here in Kentucky, the only one that could even be considered close to on the cusp is the 6th District, you know, the area surrounding Lexington, where that recently switched from Democrat to Republican. But, I mean, other than that, you're not going to buy the 4th Congressional District seat. I mean, that's going to go to a Republican. You're not going to buy the 3rd Congressional District seat. That's going to go to a Democrat. These constituencies are built in a way that it's not really going to work. So the only way you could really effectively do that would be something like the Free State Project, where everybody moves in and they buy land and they become residents of that state. Then you could do that. And in that scenario, I think that that's a valid methodology. I think that if you go back to our original, you know, when we were originally a country, people immigrated here, and when they came, they moved to an area with a similar socioeconomic group that they had left. So, you know, I grew up in German Catholic circles, so, you know, that's the area that I live in, the greater Cincinnati area. That's where German Catholics went, was to northern Kentucky. Likewise, those that were Irish Catholics stayed on the Cincinnati side of the river for the most part. And so you emigrated to areas based on the socioeconomics of where you came from and who were you comfortable with. And really it leads to more harmony at the local level for sure, because people look out for they have more in common with the people that they live around. And so there's not as much political strife, there's not as much disagreement, there's not as much debate, and you can say that's good or bad, but people get along better with people that they're comfortable with. And I think that that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think the Free State Project is very interesting. I think they made a mistake by making it New Hampshire because, I mean, New Hampshire's right next to Massachusetts, and everybody's moving in from Massachusetts and then trying to recreate Massachusetts by – it's so stupid. They move out of Massachusetts because they can't afford the taxes there anymore, and then they move to New Hampshire and vote for the same stupid programs that caused their taxes to go up that made them have to move to begin with. It's idiotic. But anyway, the point is that I have no problem if people want to move to another state and, you know, make it more liberal or more conservative or more libertarian or whatever. But it should be done in a free market way, and it should be done legitimately. You move there and you make that area different. And certainly there are opportunities to move into low population areas or areas that already lean your way anyway. And, you know, that option's already there. So if you don't like where you're living, if you don't like the rules that the community have laid down, my best recommendation to you is to move somewhere where you do like the rules, because chances are good it's going to take a long time to change the hearts and minds of people that may have moved into those areas, you know, and may have roots there for hundreds of years. And you know, that's just the way they're brought up. So just interesting anyway. Other interesting things, one of the stories I saw here in the Washington Post is about libertarian Democrats and how there's no leader for the libertarian-leaning Democrats. Now, on the Republican side, the Republican Liberty Caucus has been around for years, and there was at one time a Democratic Freedom Caucus, and the Democratic Freedom Caucus was the libertarian wing of the Democratic Party. And I don't really understand exactly why libertarian-minded folks have given up on working within the Democratic framework. I mean, if you're going to work within a party, you know, work within a party that's going to get you elected. I mean, you know, I mean, if that's your concern, Republican or Democrat shouldn't necessarily matter at that point. And so it's an interesting thing, and the story kind of came about because of the whole NSA vote, right, where we almost got the funding for the NSA spying programs cut. And it came very, very close, and there were more Democrats than the majority of the Democrats were for rolling back that program. The bill was brought forward as a bipartisan measure. Obviously, my congressman, Thomas Massey, was in support of that, and John Yarmuth in Louisville was in support of that. But unfortunately, our other four congressmen were not, and they were all Republicans. And the point being that there is a good case to be made that libertarianism needs to remain balanced. It can't only be about the economics. Economics are important, and they certainly can affect your life drastically. But equally important are your social freedoms, the Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment. You know, it's interesting. The Bill of Rights doesn't really talk too much about money. I mean, other than guaranteeing a trial by jury for matters over $20 and being secure in your possessions, the rest of it's really more about social freedom and the ability to be free. And so the point is that we need this balance, and there has been a big push on the libertarian right here, especially in large part because of Rand Paul. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but we also can't forget that there are equally important issues on the libertarian left. And that's kind of one of those interesting things that has been not really talked about a lot. And I was surprised that the Washington Post did do a story on that. And likewise, Slate Magazine did a article on Alan Grayson. Now, Alan Grayson was best known in, oh boy, what year was that? 2008, I think. And he got a lot of FaceTime because of his extreme rhetoric, and it's specifically calling out Dick Cheney. And he was known as Congressman Crazy. He was, you know, oh, he's a lunatic, whatever. Well, he lost his office, and then after redistricting, he got it back. And now that he's back, he's been doing interesting things, aligning with people like Thomas Massie and Justin Amash on social issues regarding social freedom. Now, he's still a liberal, right? He still believes in Obamacare. He still believes in Medicaid and Medicare and expanding those programs and whatnot and increasing the minimum wage. He's still a liberal. But this is a really good story about how he's been able to work with people on both sides of the aisle and inserting bills or amendments into bills in committee. And, you know, this is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, this is kind of a roadmap for, again, those libertarian-leaning Democrats that today, they kind of exist, but they're not real prominent, and there is no leader. There's an opportunity there, I guess is my point. If you're going to play the big party game, now I don't, and those that know what I do know that I don't play that game, but if you're going to play that game, you should be playing the Republican and the Democrat side. I mean, why pick one? Do both. Certainly that's what the progressives did at the beginning of the 19th century. They played both sides. There were, the House was taken over by progressive Democrats and progressive Republicans. I mean, heck, ironically, at the beginning of the 20th century, the Republicans were the big government party. The Democrats were the small government party. And, you know, the last of the small government Democrats were known as Bourbon Democrats. And John G. Carlisle was here from Kentucky, was one of the last ones in Congress before he was booted out. So the point is that if you're going to have that kind of strategy, then do it, right? And know, learn from history and look at the broader spectrum and work within that knowledge of history. Don't just focus on Republicans. I mean, if you're going to fight within the Republican Party, that's cool and all. But, you know, we've seen where our libertarians and liberty-minded Republicans can be silenced through the Republican Party. And so it's important to also have that voice on the Democratic side, so that in theory, somebody can get through on the Republican side, on the Democratic side, through the Libertarian Party, whatever. The Libertarian message is more important than party. It's a movement. And those of you in this know that the Liberty movement is broader than just one party. And so my point is that if you're going down that route, and you're getting stonewalled by Republicans, or you just get tired of working with them because some of them are just horrible to work with, you know, there are other options, legitimate options. Work within the Democratic Party, work within the Libertarian Party. Don't walk away. Don't get frustrated and walk away. That's probably the big part of it. And like I said, there's an important reason to be on this. I mean, from the Democratic side, one of the things that you're not going to have much success pushing on the Republican side is rehabbing or reforming or eliminating the drug war. That's not going to come through the Republican Party. It's just not. They should be. It costs a lot of money, and it's very ineffective. But it's not going to come through that. And even things now, there's a new study that just came out talking about how cannabis, marijuana, can help people when they're on methadone getting off of heroin. And, of course, this won't go to any sort of fanfare here in Kentucky where, you know, we're still hot and heavy against that there marijuana because, boy, it's bad, whatever. I mean, I don't smoke it, and people know that I don't. And, you know, I don't want to encourage people to do that stuff. I do think prolonged use could cause harm. I think prolonged use of anything can cause harm, or excessive use of anything can cause harm. But, you know, if somebody does that, it doesn't hurt my feelings. It doesn't affect me, as long as they don't get out on the public roads, which there's already laws against that, and there would be anyway. I really don't care. And I think we spend a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort, and we militarize our police forces over something that's really not that important. And that is what can come through a libertarian democratic strategy. That's something that right now only the Libertarian Party is really pushing. Republicans won't push it. Democrats, the ones that are liberty-leaning, just like the Republicans that are liberty-leaning, are only willing to go to hemp. And that's okay. Hemp's important. Hemp's good for the state of Kentucky. But there's a lot more good that can be done. And it can't be done through the Republican Party. It just can't. Logically, it can't. And so don't forget about the other issues. I guess that's the point. Don't forget about the other side of things. Don't just focus on what the Libertarian Republicans, the Liberty Republicans are doing, or what even what the Libertarian Party is doing. Look at the full spectrum. Where can you be the most effective? And that's going to differ based on your scenario. You know, I don't know what your local politics are. I can't. There's 120 counties in the state. I don't even know how many cities. And, you know, we should be looking at those small offices, the county offices, the city offices. Those are things that, for the most part, don't require a lot of money to win. And with some good work and a good message, you can win that. And I don't really care if you win as a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian or an Independent or whatever. As long as you're promoting liberty, it doesn't hurt my feelings. But that's, I guess, the point, is that we need to be a little less partisan. We definitely need to remember the whole message and not just the economic half. And there are ways to do that. All right, I got to get to this. We've got 10 minutes left, and I've got the whole Fancy Farm and the split in the GOP to get to. So Fancy Farm was this past weekend. It was yesterday. And there was some shenanigans that went on there, of course. The busing for Republicans has typically been done by RPK. The Republican Party sponsors those buses and drags people down to Fancy Farm. I know in 2011, when I was running for office, and in 2012, when I was there again, the Republican Party was putting those buses out and pushing them out, pushing supporters from across the state down to Fancy Farm. Well, supposedly this year, there's a little bit of confusion as to who actually paid for the buses. Was it the Republican Party or was it Mitch McConnell's campaign? And no one's really been able to answer that question yet, but what was known was that as soon as Mitch McConnell was done speaking at Fancy Farm, because they order things, they put all the elected officials first, and then the contenders come second. So after Mitch McConnell was done speaking, Allison Grimes came next, or maybe I have that backwards, but either – no, that's how it went. Allison Grimes came afterward. And once Allison Grimes was done speaking, the buses started leaving. And if you took the bus there and you wanted to ride home, you're going to have to hop that bus. And so they did not get to hear, many people did not get to hear, from Matt Bevin, who is a Republican challenging Mitch McConnell in the primary. Now, many people think I'm somehow involved with Mr. Bevin. I've never met the man. I don't know the man. Honestly, I wouldn't have picked him out of a crowd before yesterday when I watched the Fancy Farm proceedings. Whatever, I'm not here to speak about Mr. Bevin's campaign, but I do think it's kind of dirty to – it's very obvious the tone of the Republican Party, and Steve Robertson speaking on behalf of the Republican Party as their chairman, their state chairman, basically was showing his obvious bias for Mitch McConnell. And I think that that's bad in general for a political party to ever get involved in a primary. If, you know, two candidates want to run for the same office, then certainly you could try to ask the person, hey, you know, we've already got a guy here and there's nobody running for this, so why don't you run for this because we need somebody here? And that's a legitimate conversation. I don't know if you can legally have that at the federal level as a party. I thought there were rules against that, if I remember right. Maybe those rules are gone. I don't know anymore. I haven't kept up on federal election law in several years. But once it's been decided, once two people have declared for an office, I think it's very important that the party apparatus stays out of it. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, or in my case, Libertarian. I don't want to be picking winners and losers. And there was a situation like this in the Libertarian Party at one time, and we learned the hard way here just in the past 7-8 years that I've been involved, that, you know, all it does is lead to hurt feelings. And it shakes loose your supporters, and it breaks the party up, and there's no reason to do it, because at the end of the day, the primary process, whether for Republicans or Democrats, that's their paid primary, or taxpayer-funded primary, I should say, or for Libertarians who do theirs at a nominating convention, which is taxpayer-funded, there is a process by which candidates are decided upon. And you should let that process work its way. Because at the end of the day, you need your people to understand that the party's going to be there to support their good candidate, the candidate that the people at the convention or in the primary decided was the guy they wanted to represent them. You can't play favorites on this stuff. It's a really good way to divide your party. And there's already divisions occurring. I mean, the Louisville Tea Party has come out and put out a message talking about how they're not endorsing anybody in this race. But, yeah, some of their members have split, and some are supporting Bevin, and some are supporting McConnell, and some are supporting no one. But the media had picked up that the Tea Party was they had reported as if the Tea Party was actually endorsing candidates. And the Louisville Tea Party came out and said, we haven't endorsed anybody, and we're not going to. Smart. You had the national Tea Parties come in and say, well, we're supporting Mitch McConnell. And then you had some conglomeration of local Tea Parties saying, no, we're not supporting McConnell. We're supporting Bevin. So it's very interesting, this whole dynamic. And there's a split in the party, even within the Tea Party, but there's even a greater split. And that's been probably best seen in this most recent public flare-up between Chris Christie and Rand Paul. In fact, for some reason, they called me on the story, and I don't think I actually got quoted. It was some local paper in Jersey. But, you know, I said, hey, you know, I like Chris Christie's swagger, and I do. But I think Rand Paul, if I had to vote, if my choices were only between Rand Paul and Chris Christie, I'd choose Rand Paul because he's more aligned with my principles than Chris Christie is. I mean, there is no perfect candidate. There's never such thing as a perfect candidate. But voting for the best candidate is what you do. But, you know, there's been this big war between, going back further than this, you know, McCain calling the Liberty guys wacko birds and, you know, these pro-war Republicans versus the more libertarian-minded Republicans. And there's a real divide in the Republican Party right now. And I'll tell you, it's interesting. Pew Research did a poll. And the majority of Republicans think that the party needs to change. However, those that think the party needs to change are split down the middle what direction to go. Half want it to become more conservative / libertarian, and half want it to become more moderate / liberal. And I think that's a really interesting thing because you're seeing a dynamic where the Republican Party – all these major parties are built of coalitions, and I talked about this, I think, on the show in the past, where there's 9 or 10 basic categories of political persuasion, and the Republicans and Democrats each capture a portion of those pieces. Democrats currently capture 4 pieces of that of those persuasions. Republicans only capture 3, and the problem is the 3 that they have are growing apart. So the Republican Party is going to have to change. It may even have to change up its coalitions. And it may just bust apart. And make no mistake, Democrats are having the same problem. Look at the NSA vote. I mean, could you make it more clear that the Democrats are divided as well? I mean, the Democrats, the same ones that were screaming and yelling that George Bush created the Patriot Act and created all these things to support American citizens, didn't vote to defund those same programs. It's no different than the Republicans, though, that screamed and yelled about Obamacare but refused to defund it. I mean, it's great and all to be all, oh, I'm very upset about this, and boy, I'm against it. But if you don't take action against it, then really how much are you against it, and how much of it is just politics? And, you know, one of the big guys that's been a problem is Lindsey Graham. He's one of the very pro-war Republicans. And he has just drawn an opponent, Nancy Mace, in South Carolina. She's got an interesting background. I saw some of my more liberty-leaning Republican friends start to look at her and start touting her. But, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there are issues here that we should be getting more agreement on. You know, the NSA defunding that thing, right? The story that I have here shows that, you know, they say, well, we've stopped 54 specific events with all this spying. Well, the 54 specific events, only 13 of them happened in North America. And there is a breakdown from there as to how many were America versus Canada versus Mexico. So my question then is, to stop one, let's just say it's one, to stop one terrorist attack, what are you willing to give up? Are you willing to give up all of your rights? Are you this X-key score thing where they're collecting, they're doing key map scrapings of what you type? Are you willing to let the NSA see everything you type? That came out this week. Is that what you want? Do you want it so that if you're Googling the wrong things, you get a knock on the door from the feds? And there was some more information on that, but we don't have time to get into it. Is that what you want? Do you want the feds to be able to just track your cell phone without a warrant? That what you want? That came out this week. That's federal court approved that. How much are you willing to give to prevent one event, two events, five events, 10 events over the course of a decade? I mean, best case scenario, they've stopped about one every year. Is it worth giving up all of your liberty? Is it worth it? I don't think so. There's no such thing as pure safety. We'll never be 100% safe. It's just reality. It's life. There's no guarantees. There are no guarantees. You can slip and fall in your bathtub tomorrow and die. It happens. But we can't give up our rights. Folks, we're at the end of the show. I appreciate y'all tuning in. Tune in again next week, 7 p.m., same time. Tune in to the rest of the shows on the network Monday through Thursday this week, 7 p.m. Have a good week, folks. We'll be back here next week. We'll pick up what we missed and more. Have a good week.